Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, but most importantly, I'm your chief investigator of images. Big one today, listeners. Bit of a legend sat next to me right now. Dear friend, and I don't know how I managed to get you here, but I have, Mark Gatiss.
Hello.
Legend.
I got the bus.
Yeah, you got the bus. That's how you physically got here. Yeah. everybody knows you. For many, many reasons, you are right up there amongst national treasures. But you are Sherlock. You're responsible for Sherlock, Righty Sherlock. League of Gentlemen, which is where I first fell in love with you and your work. And you write and you perform and you've been in everything. Every time I turn on my television, you pop up in some weird guise.
So it would seem. I'm going to do the news next and then I'll stop.
Yeah. Yeah, then you'll have been everywhere, won't you? What are you working on at the moment? Are we allowed to know?
Yes, I am co-writing Dracula with Stephen Moffat. And we're working on the League of Gentlemen tour, which starts in the summer. First time back together. Well, on the road for 12 years, which is very exciting. Very
nostalgic. It is ridiculously exciting. I have my tickets booked. I am
good.
I cannot wait.
I'm going to smuggle some art references into it.
Oh, do, just for me, just as a teaser. When you're in Oxford, smuggle some art in. You and I have been, well, we first met a long time ago, if you recall, at a BBC Four. It was sort of a sweetener dinner, wasn't it? I thought they were going to tell us at that point the whole channel was being axed.
Yeah, it felt like it. I thought it was one of those things where you meet up and go, oh my God, we're all dead.
It was a bit like that. It felt a bit weird.
All the BBC Four presenters.
Yes.
And what I remember very well was there was one guy who, they asked for complete candor. What can we do? What are your problems with the channel? And one guy got very drunk and told the truth. And then about half an hour later, he said, I think I'm going to have to go and repair some damage because the last thing you have to do, of course, is tell the truth.
He was so drunk. He was hysterically drunk, but he was brilliant.
Yeah.
But
I've not seen him again on
I've
the channel.
I've never seen him on the television again. He was lovely. But you know, my lasting memory, so I'd only made one programme at that stage. I was a newbie, new kid on the block. And I went into this table of all these legends and I saw you and I'd been re-watching League of Gentlemen like the night before or something, and it was like reality and dream collides. And I went and I think we sat opposite each other and I'm like, oh my God, that's Mark Gatiss over the table. You looked up, you got all big eye and you went, oh my God, you're that Yanina Ramirez from the television.
Correct.
And I nearly died.
Oh, it was one of the good
most
to know.
It was one of the most messed up.
Well, I just watched your programme, whatever it was. The first one.
Really?
Oh, I must have, but otherwise I wouldn't.
No, I think you just watched it. Yeah. But anyway, it was lovely. So that's where we met.
Good.
But in the meantime, we've discovered we both love horror. And I adore Hammer Horrors, and you're my go-to for recommendations. I think my favourite thing I've ever seen on BBC Four was your horror series. That's really informed you a lot, hasn't it? What was it? Fossils, Hammer Horror and Doctor Who are your DNA.
Somewhere
your
there's
DNA.
A Venn diagram of
there
those
is.
Things, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, that documentary was it was one of those things you can't, you know, it's BBC Bristol approached me and said, do you want to do it? Would you do a history of horror movies? I went, oh, yes. But it's irresistible. But actually, I owe it a great deal because in that way that your tastes do change. I'd drifted away from horror quite a lot in a sort of straightforward way, you know, in terms of what contemporary horror was, and definitely going to see lots of horror films, stuff like that. And I rediscovered my love for it by doing that show, and also found out a lot of stuff I'd never known, or you know, and some of the more obscure European films, which
well,
I've never seen.
That was Horror Europa, wasn't it? Which was a standalone.
Yeah.
That was my favourite.
Yeah, but I mean, those films, those Mario Bava films, which I'd only ever really seen a handful of, or they existed as black and white stills when I was a child, and you used to go, what is that? Barbara Steele, who I interviewed, you know, who's a legend of European horror movies, but I remember looking at her picture going, but who is this woman? Because we never saw her. She wasn't present. And now some of those films are amongst my absolute favourites because they are much more transgressive than we were doing over here. They actually make Hammer, much as I love it, they make Hammer look quite quaint.
Absolutely. They are very dark.
Very odd.
Oh, and some of the, I mean, they're very discomforting, aren't they? I mean, Hammer puts you on the edge of your seats. This makes your head screw upside down. And and the look as well. I mean, what I loved about those, all of the documentaries, but Hammer Europa in particular, was the aesthetic you managed to get in the cinematography with that wonderful sort of muted colours and then the bursts of your blue suit or the burst of the red. It was very cleverly done to look.
It's all about art, Nina.
Oh my God, Mark, your eye. You've got such an eye. No, but it was very, very awesome. As you know, I loved it. Horror. And so when I said to you, will you do an art detective? I didn't know what you were going to come back with, really. I was waiting to see. You came back with some incredible diverse choices. I should also add at this point as well, one of the other communications we've had recently, you've been sending me images of your paintings and you are good. You are ridiculously good. I think I wrote back and went, bloody good. How long have you been painting?
Well, I've always loved art. I've always drawn. And I started painting about 20 years ago, I think. I love going to galleries and I'm very drawn to the history of art and all kinds of different aspects of people's personalities and lives. I love portraits particularly.
That's what I thought. Your portrait show is incredible. It was just a close-up. Was it the John Milton one that you'd done? Was it like a...
John Minton.
With the charcoal.
Yes,
that was incredible.
Thank you.
Really delicate, really good.
But then I didn't know if I could really do it. And then I started. But it's been very intermittent. But recently, I've really got back into it. I find it incredibly therapeutic.
It is, isn't it?
And it takes you somewhere else, doesn't it? But I just want to get better all the time. And I love what it does. It scratches at a creative itch. You can get to the end of a day and you feel like you've really done something. But it uses a different part of your brain somehow.
I feel exactly the same. I don't get nearly enough time to paint. But there is something, when you're a creative person and you're writing particularly, when you're making words and you're thinking and you're working through material and research, painting is still incredibly productive and you still, as a creative person, feel you're doing. But you're right, there is this sort of clearing of the mind that takes place. Yeah. And you're doing something so technical and hand and skilled with your hands.
Yeah, yeah. It's a hand-eye thing. And I find that very interesting. Like, it's the only thing that can make me forget a cup of tea.
Oh!
I make a cup of tea and I'll turn around and realise it's gone cold and I've forgotten it.
Would you forget a cocktail, though?
Oh, yes. Tea is much less likely to happen than a cocktail.
Well, so, I mean, I'm so delighted to hear that. It was a real revelation to me that you painted, but B, that you have this rich appreciation for art. You've been working on a documentary just recently.
Yes, but John Minton, who's my favourite painter, is a 40s and 50s painter, and I've always loved his pictures. I own three of them, and... I have been to Christie's before. As you can see, I have this arm and this leg are missing from my visit to Christie's. And I made the documentary off my own back because I couldn't get anyone interested. He's quite an obscure figure. But happily, the BBC then retrospectively commissioned it. So it's on BBC Four. But it was a real labour of love and I had to shoot it over many, many months and try and keep my hair the same. But all the continuity things that you normally don't worry about because you sort of do, obviously, you tend to do. It wasn't. It took the weather. And I chose this sort of outfit, which in the spring of last year, which I was wearing by the Thames in November.
Absolutely. Okay. I've been there.
It's crazy.
Nice, boiling hot in the summer, freezing cold in the winter. But it's awful for continuity. I'm really excited about that. So that's sort of art history, art context. You're obviously applying that in the art that you're making, but you've got very diverse and eclectic tastes. When we sort of started to hone in on what we were going to talk about, we dallied with Velasquez, we were going to do a bit of Caravaggio, who will pop up. But you went a bit more Baroque and a bit more obscure. What were your choices and why?
Well, it's like Desert Island Discs,
isn't it?
I don't know. Trying to narrow something down is very difficult and you sort of go, well, what do I like today?
Exactly. Or, mood. Yeah. Like mood music. What's your favourite song today?
Some of the pictures I always go back to, and that's always a good sign, isn't it? If you sort of find yourself drifting through the National Gallery or going back to the same picture, that something's speaking to you.
Absolutely.
The first one, though, is in the Met, I believe, it's called...
It is in the Met. It is called...
The Fortune Teller.
Yeah.
By Georges de la Tour. And I think I'd seen some of his pictures before. They're very distinctive, very curious. Everyone has a very similar sort of
wide-eyed face. And I just love the story. It's very Caravaggio-esque.
It is.
And it's definitely influenced by Caravaggio's picture, the Card Sharps. Mm-hmm. But it's just a fantastic story. It's a young man being diddled by a gypsy fortune teller. She's taking his money or crossing his palm with silver whilst his purse is being lifted from his buff jerkin. But I love the side eye of the woman next to him.
This one.
Amazing character face of the fortune teller herself. His kind of, I mean, he's just so green, isn't he? His face is so smooth.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful picture, and I love the colour. The older I get, the more I love colour. I kind of, you know, as I say, you go in phases, don't you? And my taste in horror has altered completely. My absolute favourite thing always are ghost stories, but I'm so squeamish now.
Seriously?
Can't stand it. I can't. Some stuff I could bear when I was 14, I can't look at.
So you can't do gore or you can't do fear?
Oh, no, fear's fine. It's gore.
It's gore.
I can't stand it. Yeah. And but then in a funny kind of way, having been, you know, when I was a kid, all my favourite bands were like Ultravox and John Fox and Bauhaus.
Why does that not surprise me?
But I love colour. I love colour, and I love it in art, especially. I really respond to it to cheers me up. I mean,
that's actually what intrigued me about your choices. They are incredibly bright, and textured as well. Yeah, I mean, we were talking about Caravaggio because, of course, they've got tenebrism. You've got such extreme ends of light and dark. It's not even chiaroscuro anymore. It's like actual shadows. Whereas this, I think that this is a bright picture. It says the influence of Caravaggio is clearly there, and you know, we know that he was looking at his work for inspiration. But I see this as almost an antithesis. It glows, it zings with colour and light.
But I like that. I think it's a daytime scene, isn't it? There's extraordinary colour in it. It's sort of corals almost.
Well, this is it. I think this colour around here. Yeah. But again, the contrasts with the colour on the sleeve of the old gypsy lady over there, it's almost a clash.
Yeah.
It could be really uncomfortable, but in the hands of a great painter, it's actually formed beautiful partitions and structure lines.
Yes, the composition is fantastic.
Yeah.
Takes you straight down to the hand into the pocket.
Exactly. The centre point is the hand here. I mean, we've got this action, which is the crossing of the palm with the silver. You know, this is both symbolic of the fact he wants his fortune read, but it's also that he's going to be robbed. Yeah. he's been robbed in one of the most hysterical ways. I find this is like a three-way robbing.
But he's also, and it's worth saying, and is a recurring theme in many of my favourite pictures, he's quite dishy, isn't he?
He's, well, yeah. Okay, I'll give you that. He's got good hair.
He's quite dishy.
He has got very, very nice hair.
But, of course, one thing we've both discovered doing a little bit more reading around this, is this by Georges de Lautoy?
Well, shall we get into our surprise discovery?
Yes.
Well, so, context. It's currently, this is currently in the Met. And it was purchased discovered in 1960, rediscovered, signed, and the Met paid lots of money for it, and it is recognised as an original. But we've just been reading that there's some controversy, isn't there?
Well, quite recently, yes, quite recent controversy, someone alleging it was faked in the 20s, along with several. And the more that de Lautoy became popular, the more of them seemed to be discovered.
Funnily enough, because he was not a popular artist right up, as you say, till the 1920s. And then this flavour starts and his work starts to reach higher and higher marks. And then we get miraculous discoveries. Oh, look, it's just a priest saw a picture of a photograph of an image in a castle. Yeah.
But it's one thing to allege that, but now they can test how old the paint is, surely. Yeah. I've watched Fake or Fortune.
You've seen them peeling away the layers. well, this is just the tip of the iceberg with his work, isn't it? Because the other one that I've pulled up is The Cheat, which is probably his most famous work. And it is a fabulous picture. I mean, again, I think the things you've chosen are really interesting because they're 17th century paintings, but they're completely secular. They're sort of about, I mean, in this case, it's almost the sort of the edge of the establishment, the edge of where it becomes slightly decadent and deviant. Mm. So it's gambling, it's drinking, it's fortune telling, it's gypsies. It's just sort of on the edges of society, isn't it? But this one is particularly problematic because there are, in fact, three versions / copies of the cheats.
Which, you know, again, of course, is a familiar thing in terms of studio copies.
Right.
Or pupils
off,
doing it,
exactly.
And then the face is done by the master, etc. So it's not. But because of this forgery allegation, it starts to then look. This is very interesting. I have to say, I think that the fortune tellers is a better picture. So if it is a fake, I prefer the forger.
Do you?
To Josh.
Well, this is something we need to discuss, actually. But I just wanted to give the context, because we were both reading up about it, obviously. Mm. The English art historian Christopher Wright published The Art of the Forger in 1984, and it claims that the Met's fortune teller, along with other works attributed to Latour, is actually forgeries of the 1920s artist and restorer Emile Delobre. So you actually know who your forger is.
My favourite painter.
He's your favourite painter. Yeah. Jumped to the top. But what was so funny when I was reading about these three different versions, sorry, I must stop laughing because this is a very in joke. But apparently on the Louvre copy, in the collar of one of the women, it's written, merde, shit.
And they believed it and took it off.
I know.
But what if that was de Latour's joke?
Well, this is it.
It's
all very bizarre.
I'm going to use a nice word. It's murky, isn't it?
Well, this is something I've just, as I was saying to you, I have been rather outspoken recently about my feelings about multi-million pound artworks changing hands and the... it leaves me cold a lot of the time because, there's this Modigliani's just gone for, 150 today? And we're still reeling from Salvador Mundi, from the Leonardo, and the price tags are just going ridiculous now. Mm. But one of the things you were saying is fake or fortune, this recent exhibition.
Which you actually like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it fascinating, though. It was those Van Meegeren and the fake Vermeers. When you look at them now, they're just terrible. You think, it makes you question at what stage do you actually believe people? Because how anyone could have fallen for those?
there are some seriously bad ones. But, Sean Greenley, who was the Bolton forger with the shed and did the amazing alabaster. I mean, he did everything and he's a good friend. I know him. And I think he's an extraordinary artist. Yeah. And this is, again, that borderline between at what point is the work of the forger to be considered art? Because if that's a forgery, good artwork.
I think at the point of which they go to prison.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
but I like, there's something great about that, isn't there? But there's do you know an artist called Mark Beard? No, he's fascinating because he wasn't selling. So he decided to invent a persona, Bruce Sargent, who he claims to be descended from, who is sort of cross between John Singer Sargent and Bruce Weber. And he paints in the style of an early 20th century American homoeroticist. And then he invented a persona of the man who taught him, who paints in a different way, and then a pupil who's slightly later in the century. They all sell for thousands.
Dear God, I did not know that.
Oh, they're brilliant. They're brilliant.
Well, I love the art, but I didn't know the backstory. But but then again, it's this borderline, isn't it? Mm. It's and as we were saying earlier, I mean, it's something that people like Warhol were flagging up so clearly with things like the factory. But you have schools, you have teams of collaborative artists. You know, a Rembrandt is not just a Rembrandt. It's the school of Rembrandt because, as you say, someone's doing all the boring grass in the foreground. Rembrandt sweeps in, sticks a gorgeous face on it.
But then also, when you look at restorers, these people are amazing.
Otherwise,
they would not be doing it. So when you look, and I was watching a thing about the suffragettes attacking the picture of Henry James in the National Gallery, which is a beautiful Sargent picture. It's really badly damaged, not now. So someone had the incredible talent to be able to completely ventriloquize Sargent to the extent where you just don't know anymore.
The edges are so blurry, and we've ended up with names carrying the value. Mm. But actually, our eyes can judge value. We can be, like you say, that the copies of the Vermeer don't look right. And if you look carefully enough, I mean, there is something that is clearly distinctive about Latour's style.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's the faces, it's the side eyes, which are just extraordinary, yeah. aren't they? But there is a sort of mask-like quality mm. that only his works capture. Mm. They're sort of fixed, frontally posed, like they're performing in a play or something.
And there's something, I mean, it's hard to say from this distance, isn't it? But the costumes do feel heightened. There's something slightly kind of fancy dress about
them.
Yeah,
theatrical.
But then, you know, that also, that Rembrandt, as you mentioned, Rembrandt's studio is just full of amazing props.
Exactly.
It's like, I'm going to get a tramp and dress him as a king.
Yeah.
And put this ermine, that's what they did. So
of course they did.
From this distance, it's almost impossible to tell. And I hate it when people have extremely kind of they're very definite about it must be this.
Absolutely.
You know, I have this problem all the time when I'm making anything set in the past. There's always a historical advisor. Which is, of course, great and fine, but they'll tell you that this is how people bowed. This is how people dance, particularly.
Oh, yeah.
And you go, what about the people who were shit at it?
the ones who were so maverick
yeah.
that they just danced like no one was yeah. watching.
Everyone's hair was this length.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't, because some people didn't give a monkey.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to. It's like a terrible sort of orthodoxy
yeah.
about it. And in the same way, from this distance, you look at these wonderful painters and their strange lives, and their obviously bohemian and curious lives, all kinds of things
Absolutely.
Might come into it.
You know? Well, you'll like this phrase. I use this a lot with my students. It's a great little word, multivalence, mm. which is the coexistence of multiple interpretations and meanings.
Oh, I like
where
that.
One does not erode the other. And there's constantly
multivalence. Yes, exactly. There's room for everything.
There's room for everything. Yeah. There's room for multiple interpretations. And then, you know, there's that whole layer of what we bring to it as people and viewers ourselves.
There's a wonderful story about Orson Welles' film, The Lady from Shanghai. Very curious film. It's the one that with Rita Hayworth ends with The Hall of Mirrors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
It's a mad film, beautifully shot, odd. And there's a very strange scene where they go to have a picnic in sort of in the jungle on the side of it. It's really curious. But there's a massive close-up of a macaw, I'm thinking, just going, ah! And people have written reams of essays about what this means. And then someone asked Welles about a year before he died, and he said, I just thought maybe the audience needed to wake up around then. That's all it is.
The symbolism. You know? Yeah, no, it's a representation of dare.
Yes.
It's clearly dare. No, I love all that. I love misreadings as much as I like real readings. But yeah, so I think we can obviously overinterpret. I think what this is a pleasurable cuckolding of a sexy young man by gypsy ladies. I love the fact that, you know, one is cutting the thread on his bed,
yeah.
on his bedall. The other one's got a hand getting the wallet out at the back. It's a proper mugging, but yeah. he's oblivious.
It's a lovely story. I just think it's a gorgeous picture.
It is a gorgeous picture. It's a very, very good choice. But I want to get on to a couple of your other choices. So we wanted to talk about forgery. One of the things that's interesting, of course, about his style is that it's widely said that he's influenced by Caravaggio. And this is, again, I brought in another example, Joseph the Carpenter, 1642, because he's reputed to be the master of candlelight, nighttime light at this stage. And you can see that, can't you? But look at the face. It's still,
yeah,
it's still got the quality,
still
hasn't
that
it?
Curious shape,
still
isn't
that
it?
Weird it's, yeah. master
But not so
shape.
Much on Joseph, actually.
He's quite That's realistic. And in fact, yeah. actually, if you look at the cheat again as well, while the woman and these characters, he's got
yes,
a right realism
true.
In his
That's
turn,
true.
Hasn't he?
So that's interesting, isn't it? I wonder if that, well. Unless that's someone else.
Well, that looks fake now, don't you think?
That looks fake?
Don't you think?
Because it is, because it's less.
It just looks wrong, doesn't it? Anyway, we can...
They'll probably take that out like nailed.
Yeah.
just
that face
just
is bad.
Wipe it out.
Get the tip
Get the white spirit out, yes.
Cover it over. But yes, so Caravaggio is looming heavy. And one of the things... I mean, Caravaggio is a complete swine. Again, if we were talking about artists' lives influencing their
oh,
art.
Oh, yes.
Good grief. Murderer. Actually,
actual
murderer.
No, you don't get many of those.
An ones. Actual murderer, yeah. yes. But he can't do blood, we were saying. Can't we? So we're
yes,
looking
that's
currently...
What intrigues me.
At his Judith beheading Holofernes, which is 1602.
Well, the one I want to talk about is Gentileschi's
yeah.
Judith slaying Holofernes, because it's brilliant. But to put it next to it is Caravaggio's also beautiful picture. But fascinatingly, for a man who could do anything, he can't do blood. I noticed this first on his medallion portrait of the head of Medusa.
Which is one of the most extraordinary pieces ever made.
But he can't do blood.
But he can't do blood.
I think he's trying to do the action of it spurting, obviously. Yeah. But it looks like red wool.
Or, yeah, silly string.
Whereas Gentileschi's, the blood is drenching the bed. It's totally realistic. It's a fantastically violent image and completely real. And of course, has to be, I think, massively informed by her own personal history.
Well, she is so legendary for so many reasons. She is the female exemplar that all feminist art historians cling to, that there was this woman in the 17th century who wasn't just a woman, a token woman painter. She was damn good. She was up there beating the best of them at their game. And, you know, from such a young age, she was clearly gifted. But she has a tragic life, doesn't she?
Yes, she was raped by her tutor, possibly another man. And then there was an understanding that they would marry, which he reneged on. And then her father then prosecuted him. It doesn't end brilliantly because he was found guilty and banished, but didn't really do it. But it's an incredible thing. And I think, you know, you look at this picture is just replete with a real sort of, well, it's fury.
It's fury.
But the face of Judith is extremely sort of calmly determined.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at the Caravaggio, the same subject, there's a sort of disgust and horror in it.
I'm sort of killing it, but I really don't want to be killing him. And also, I mean, there's so many things we could say, but the composition is entirely inverted. So in this case, In the Caravaggio, you know, she is holding him at arm's length while she slits his throat. But she looks horrified. But look at the proportions of the scale. Look at the size of his head compared to her. She's this diminutive little lady. Whereas you've got absolutely none of that going on in the Gentileschi.
Well, it's the act. Look at that. There's violence in it. It's like someone who knows what they're doing. Whereas in the Caravaggio, she could be sort of slitting open a cantaloupe. This is
everyone
like
everyone for melon.
Yeah,
yeah. No, this is absolutely
hold him down and slit
him.
His throat. It's
well, it's brilliant. Cutting, and I think you're right about the blood. The blood is the key, isn't it? Because as you say,
the blood is the life.
The blood is the key to unlocking this image. Because Caravaggio, legend. I mean, I love Caravaggio's work. They're often some of my favourite paintings in the history of art. But he can't do blood. But if Gentileschi hadn't have made her version of this, this would be incredible and unparalleled and unbeatable. I mean, it's tortured. The muscle work on that is incredible. It's well structured. But the fact that she chose to engage almost in an art historical dialogue by doing her own version of this story makes it 10 times more powerful. Because
I think it's an absolutely magnificent picture. It's better than the Caravaggio.
It is absolutely better than Caravaggio, which is something to say.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what is so interesting is the power of the woman. There is a sense in which she's getting revenge, the way that the sword cuts right the way through the neck. It is vengeful and passionate. Mm. But this is a woman who in the early 17th century had the courage to take a man to court for raping her.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's difficult now for women. And this is like hundreds of years ago. She's unbelievable. And then we love her other work, don't we? So she's known for the Judith, but she's also famous for her Susanna and the Elders, which has since become a bit of a meme online because it's men mansplaining to the woman who is naked and vulnerable. And I know we end up sort of putting our own modern approaches to feminism and feminist issues backwards on the time. But she seems to be doing something quite radical and feminist here.
Well, she's, Susanna is not happy with what the Elders are proposing, whereas in other versions, it's sort of much more of the time. It's a sort of understanding that's what's going to happen. So you can't help but see it as a very different, she has a very different attitude to these subjects.
Absolutely.
I mean, I absolutely love, I think one of the greatest things about the history of art is the idea of a subject being reinterpreted constantly. So any given version of the crucifixion, the deposition, the annunciation, or apocrypha from the Bible, you can look at it so many different ways, and then it inevitably feels like a product of its time, doesn't it? It just speaks differently.
It reflects both the zeitgeist, it reflects the society in which it's made, and the individual mind that's making it. That's what's so magical about it. It's both collaborative and individual and unique. I mean, it goes bonkers, doesn't it? You've got sort of baby Jesus, who was apparently born in a stable, on a bejeweled throne with a kind of a crown on.
Well, I have a particular fondness / horror of those weird fat Jesuses.
Oh, they are terrifying.
The baby Jesuses that are just like, have you ever seen a human child?
There is a reason for that, though, that they couldn't actually get access to babies in a studio. It's a little bit like the fact that they had to use, if they were ever going to get a female model, it would have to be a prostitute.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that the babies just don't look like real babies because they're not based on real babies.
It's sort of, you know, those pictures of rhinos and lions before people had seen them.
They
just
heard
stories.
I've heard about this thing called a baby. It's like a little man. Yeah. Make the man small.
It's very like a little man.
Put a real man's head on a little body and you've got a baby. Yeah, they are horrendous. But I mean, I was intrigued by these artworks that you chose because you've picked pieces that are quite distant in time. I kind of thought you might be. What are your tastes currently going forward? I mean, obviously
it's all over. You know, so it just depends. It's what I'm liking today. You know, and the things I'm drawn to. I love the Impressionists, and I love Alfred Sisley.
I love
Sickert. Some of the obvious ones, some of the less obvious ones. I would say as a whole century, the century I like the least is the 18th century.
Oh, you have just read my. That's what I say officially.
Good.
That's what I sadly end up saying that to my students. Yeah, can't do it.
It's not that, you know, there are of course masterworks. It's just it's always the bit I sort of drift through more. I find the landscapes quite dull. Mm. Most of the portraits quite stolid and static, and then. And I tell you what, but I have made a discovery recently. I saw a wonderful thing about Constable's sketchbook.
Oh my gosh! I had a student write a PhD thesis on this, a dissertation on this. So Constable's sketches are the antithesis of what he ends up putting on his
canvas. Constable's sketchbook is Impressionism 100 years. You know, they're absolutely wonderful, but because they're oil sketches and they're quick. But they are so much. Everything else is too finished.
Absolutely.
It's not its fault. It's become genuinely chocolate boxy, jigsawy, because it's so polished. But his quick sketches are like heart stopping.
But they're almost like photographic negatives. Mm. But they're moody and they're dark, and then they become so saccharine when he puts them into oil. Have you seen the V&A sketches? The big blown up ones that he's done. We'll go to the V&A. I'll show you them. And that's another episode. Mm. We have talked for ages. We've got to let you get back to the busy, heady world of writing and creating.
Just go outside in the sunshine.
Oh, there you go. Go and have another ice cream, an obbly bobbly. What a pleasure. I love meeting up with you.
Thank you. It's been lovely. I could do it all day.
I know. Well, we'll have to do another one.
Get to Van Dyck.
I know.
Next time.
That's part two. Yeah. Thank you,
Thank
Mark.
Thank you.